You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Good evening, everybody. Hello and welcome. I am your eager moderator, Steve Call, and from Columbia University, and also involved with the U.S. Programs Board here at Open Society, and very pleased to be a part of this tonight because we have two really thoughtful individuals, one a journalist, the other a career diplomat and policymaker across a number of administrations, and both have spent quite a lot of time in Afghanistan on the ground across different eras of the country's experience of international intervention since 2001, and have very hard-won and I think very well-grounded perspectives that will probably partially overlap and partially differ, but will be very valuable to hear. You're here under the rubric of the American legacy in Afghanistan, and I think that's what our two speakers will address in their initial remarks, but I hope we'll range far and wide in our conversation as we go along, and in particular, I want to mention Anand's new book, the title of which is No Good Men Among the Living. And I noticed it on a table outside, and of course, I'm sure some of you are here because you already know that Anand has been one of the most intrepid and original reporters in Afghanistan over the last 5 or 10 years. He traveled with the Taliban successfully and voluntarily, and spent a lot of time in Kandahar and other parts of southern Afghanistan and central Afghanistan that were generally inaccessible to international reporters. And more than his intrepidness is the depth of his analytical work and his thinking and his research, which really veers into scholarship in many cases, the papers he's done about the complexity of the origins of the Taliban and the sort of political social mapping of Kandahar, really are beyond journalism in a lot of ways and more in scholarship and ethnography. And in David's case, I don't know how much of this you'll hear from him, but he was sent to Kabul as a diplomat very early in the period after Operation Enduring Freedom, essentially helped to open up the decrepit American embassy that had been mothballed in the late 1980s in Kabul, and through a whole series of roles and iterations from that initial deployment right through to shaping policy at the Pentagon and in the interagency setting, has had a long and a very, as I say, grounded, independent-minded experience of Afghanistan throughout, and find him a very sort of forthright and committed diplomat, not somebody who was trying to polish his career all along, but just trying to do the job and to try to describe the facts as he saw them, which is, as those of you who interview diplomats know, is a rare and prized characteristic. So it's really a great combination, and so our format's fairly simple. We'll have each of our speakers address the subject at hand for 10 minutes or so, and then I might ask them a few questions up here to get the conversation started, and then we'll invite you in and get you on your way in time for dinner or playoff basketball or whatever it is that's out there. Anand has agreed to begin.
Thanks, Steve. In thinking about the legacy of the American war in Afghanistan, which is why we're here, I thought back to the last time I was in the country, which is 3 months ago, and I had actually, in the course of writing my book, I'd been away for a couple years. numbers. Because I'd lived in the country from 2008 to about 2011, and then I'd been away writing. And so when I went back to the country, I was very interested in seeing how much had changed. And so I decided to take a trip. And I started in Shamali, which is a bit north of Kabul. And I started there because I start my book there as well. On the eve of 9/11, Shamali was a ravaged part of the countryside. It had been for generations the place where Afghanistan had produced grapes that had gone throughout South Asia. Under the Taliban's rule against, in their fight against the Northern Alliance, they essentially had a scorched earth campaign on Shamali, where they devastated the countryside, they drove thousands of people into exile, they summarily executed people. And keeping that in mind, when I went to Shamali, it was striking to see how different things had become. The roads are now paved. Hundreds of thousands of Afghans have now come back to the Shamali. There were schools that are open. There were many girls' schools. Of course, we know famously the Taliban had outlawed female education. There was electricity everywhere. I talked to people about the elections. This was about a month before the presidential elections. And there was hope, there was anticipation, there was excitement to take part in an election in which Hamid Karzai was not going to be involved. Talking to people there and seeing their experiences and seeing how much it transformed in just 10 years really gives you a sense of the Afghan spirit, which is pretty impressive. I went from Shamali to Kabul. And again, it was a similar story. If you talk to Afghans about how life was in the 1990s under the Taliban, Kabul was a ghost town. I mean, we all know that the Taliban famously imprisoned women in their houses, but even men didn't read very much because there was no jobs. You would go outside and you could be caught by the religious police, and if you didn't have a beard that was long enough, you would be whipped, you'd be jailed. Today, if you go to Kabul, you'll see bumper-to-bumper traffic. There are cafes, there are supermarkets. There's a thriving entrepreneurial class. There are students, young students who now speak English, who are integrated into the global world through the internet, through television. And of course, there are also girls that are going to school, which didn't happen in the Taliban. And for many years, I think Kabul epitomized the boom that Afghanistan had experienced post-2001. And so I spent a few days in Kabul, saw some friends. And then I went southwest through a suburb called Kampani, which is the very limit of Kabul. I passed a nondescript police checkpoint. And you wouldn't know it crossing through at the moment, but on the other side of that checkpoint was really a different country from what I've just described. The other side is a province called Wardak province. There, the Afghan government controls just the towns, and there's only one or two towns in the province. And the highways. Outside of the towns and highways, everything is controlled either by the Taliban insurgency or by American-backed warlords. I went to a district called Saidabad District, where there's two warlords who are holding power. Both of them are people who were small-time businessmen in the 1990s. They had become contractors delivering fuel to NATO bases in the last 10 years. And the process that became incredibly wealthy and incredibly powerful. And they're the real authorities inside of that district, not the Afghan government, not even the US forces, there are very few left there, not the Afghan army, but these two power brokers. When I was there, I was caught in a fight between these two because what had happened is one contractor had supported one Taliban group. Remember, these are pro-American contractors, but they also had ties to the Taliban. One contractor supported one Taliban group, and another contractor supported another Taliban group. And in the process, there was a firefight across the highway, which killed three people and destroyed three homes. I went from Saidabad district to Nerk district, which is another district in Wardak, which is home to a different sort of fight, and this is between insurgent groups. One group is the Taliban, and the other group is another insurgent group called Hizb Islami. And these two groups had been fighting for the last year and a half. And you wouldn't hear this in the media because no one's really gone there, but this is something that's brought life to a standstill in these villages. I went to an area where people are living on this big mountainside. On the top of the mountain, which is controlled by the Taliban, people have apple trees. And for generations, they've been growing apples and bringing them down the mountainside and selling them in the bazaar. The Taliban today control the top of the mountain, and the bottom of the mountain is controlled by Hizb Islami, the other insurgent group. And because there's a war between the two, if you bring your apples from the top to the bottom, they won't let you pass. They say those are Taliban apples, and so you can't go through. And so people have been driven to penury because of this fight. Some people, because they have no choice, have decided to brave going through the mountain, through the summits of the mountains, and trying to take the long route to the bazaar. And so when I was there, half dozen people had just arrived at the hospital from frostbite. They had died because they were trying to do this. From this area in Nerk, I went to a village called Ibrahim Khail. Ibrahim Khail was a village that's been, again, a center of the fight between the US and the Taliban forces. When I went there, most of the village was talking about an incident that had happened 4 months prior. There was a man whom I'll call Janan. And Janan was a wood seller. So he would take wood that was chopped up from the forest, he'd put it on his truck, and he'd drive it 5 miles to the bazaar. At the same time, the Special Forces unit in the area had received intelligence that there was a suicide bomber in there that was driving around with a wood truck. So 3 days later, 3 days after they received that intelligence, Janan was driving his truck near his village when the Special Forces stopped him, forced him out of the car, and in full view of a dozen villagers, all of whom I had interviewed, he was beaten close to death. And then one of the soldiers, either a translator, Afghan translator, or a soldier himself, climbed into the car, drove over him, and then threw his body into the river. I mean, this may sound shocking, but in fact, Matthew Akins wrote a great piece in the Rolling Stone detailing the activities of this unit, the Special Forces unit in question. I think it came out 6 months ago or so, in the same village. And this is just one of many stories like this. His body was tossed in the village, his family fished it out, and they rushed him to the hospital, but he had died. I went from that village to Saidabad, back to Saidabad, and I was interested in the question of female education. In Shamali and in Kabul, I saw girls going to school. I met people who were excited, enthusiastic about the change that happened in the last 10 years, and I was curious to see if this would hold in the middle of the war zone. There are stats you may read about X million, I don't know what the number is, but there's some X million number of girls are going to school after 2001. There's a great report out by SIGAR, Special Investigator General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, who cast doubt on these sorts of figures just because these figures are produced by the Afghan government, who have an incentive to produce these figures, and there's no way to actually vet them. Nobody's actually going to these schools. So that day I went to six girls' schools, which I took from the official Ministry of Education list. All six were closed and hadn't been open for years. I spoke to somebody who was a good friend of mine. She's a gynecologist, one of the bravest women I've ever met. She ran a women's health clinic under the Taliban without the Taliban's knowledge. And post-2001, she's been continuing to do extraordinary work in her village in Saidabad. And I asked her to take me around to schools and to explain to me how things have changed. And she told me that in 2001, there were 22 girls' schools in Saidabad district. Today, there's one. I went from Saidabad further south. I went to left Wardak. I went to Ghazni, Logar, various other provinces that are war-torn. And I ended up in the outskirts of a province called Paktika, which borders Pakistan. In Paktika province, the most powerful person is not the governor. He is not the chief of police. In fact, the most powerful person in this province does not actually have a position in the government at all. His name is Azizullah. He's a commander. He gets paid and he's funded. He's armed by the U.S. Special Forces. And in Paktika, whatever Azizullah says goes. And so I spent 3 days interviewing people and asking them how life was in Paktika, and every single person would mention how Azizullah was making the life of basically a living hell. And I'll just give you one example. I met somebody, I'll call him Wahidullah. And he told me a story of something that happened to his cousin. His cousin was 13 years old, and this was last year, right after the new year in Afghanistan. His cousin, 13 years old, was arrested by Azizullah's forces on suspicions of being an insurgent. He was taken to Azizullah's base and kept for a night and gang-raped by six militiamen. He was released the next day and said he was free to go home. So I'm telling you these stories not to shock you or just tell you something outlandish, but to put the spotlight on the reality of Afghanistan, which is really two realities. The late great David Foster Wallace said in a commencement speech a few years ago, he said that the value of education is not so much teaching you how to think, it's to teach you that you have a choice on what to think about. And when we think about the legacy of the United States and Afghanistan, we also have a choice in what to think about. We can think just about the areas in Kabul and in the north which are peaceful and which have seen tremendous gains. And we can close our eyes to the everyday depravity that's happening in the countryside. Or we can choose to think about both and recognize that the American legacy in Afghanistan is extraordinarily complicated. And I bring this up because, and I know we only have, I guess, a few more minutes, right? I bring this up because if we want to think about where Afghanistan's going, we need to have a reckoning of how it's gotten where it is and our role, meaning the United States' role, in this. And that's basically what my book is really about, is looking at how we have been wittingly or unwittingly complicit in the state of affairs in Afghanistan. The book follows the lives of three Afghans. One is a Taliban commander. He surrendered, or he quit after 2001, like thousands of other Taliban fighters, and tried to open up a shop. He tried various other ways to integrate into Afghan society. And it turned out he couldn't because of the warlords and commanders that we were backing. He was driven back into the insurgency, and he rose to become a prominent anti-US insurgent over the last few years. So the book tells his story from 2001 to today. It also tells the story of somebody who is a prominent Afghan politician or a warlord. His name is John Muhammad from Uruzgan province. And he was somebody who was an anti-Taliban, I guess, activist or figure in the 1990s. He was arrested and tortured very severely by the Taliban. He was released, and after 2001, he rose to incredible levels of wealth and power because of his alliance with the United States military. And through that alliance, he actually fingered a lot of his own enemies who ended up being sent to Guantanamo or being sent to Bagram prison. And he became very powerful in the process. The third person that I follow is a housewife who grew up in Kabul. And during the civil war of the 1990s, was forced to flee into the countryside. And through what I learned, what was very surprising to me, through speaking to her and reporting her experience, is that the stark differences between how life is for a woman in the countryside versus the cities where we usually hear news from Afghanistan. And for the next 10 years, she was forced to navigate between various forces, between the Taliban and US-backed commanders, and find a way to survive, which ultimately I think is what most Afghans actually are trying to do, even though we tend to think of it as strictly delineated categories between good guys and bad guys. So that's what the book is about. Where the book leaves off is setting up how we've gotten to where we are. So I just want to talk a little bit, since we are talking about the legacy of the United States in Afghanistan, talk a little bit about where we are leaving Afghanistan after 2014. Most troops are expected to leave. Here are some facts that people may or may not know. Number one is that the Afghan government gets 30% of its expenditures come from domestic revenue. That means the rest of it, 70%, come from foreign aid. In other words, the Afghan government cannot survive if foreign powers do not prop it up. This is no different, really, than the early 1990s, when the Afghan government then, which was communist, could not survive if the Soviet Union did not prop it up. So in other words, we have bequeathed upon Afghanistan a state which is not sustainable. And I say we have bequeathed because it's not, this state of affairs doesn't exist because the Afghans are just preternaturally corrupt or they don't know how to run a state. It's actually because of conscious policy decisions over the last 10 or 11 years by the United States and others. And I'll give you a couple of examples of this. Number one, for every dollar the United States spent on state building or nation building or spent on the Afghan government itself, it spent more on warlords and power brokers outside of the Afghan government. It's spent on people like Azizullah, the person I described in Paktika, whose people had raped at war. This creates a culture of impunity, because as long as there are power brokers who don't rely on popular mobilization for their support, they rely on foreign patronage, then questions of legitimacy are irrelevant to them. As long as they can pay their men to fight for them, they can continue to do whatever they want, and they exist outside of the rule of law. Azizullah is not alone in this. There's dozens of other commanders that are like this, hundreds, I would say, even, of commanders like this. It creates a very weak state in which the state basically exists in the cities and in the towns, and it struggles to compete with these warlords for legitimacy. And one of two things happen. Either they enter the same game as these warlords to keep up for patronage, for funding, or at worst, or at best, they try to absorb these warlords into the state. A lot of these guys become police chiefs. What ends up happening is these warlords bring their militias into the state, and the impunity continues, and it bleeds into the state. And this has been the story of the last 10 or 11 or 12 years. And this is why, when you talk to Afghans in places like Wardak or Kandahar or Paktika, they tell you that they feel that they are trapped between, on the one side, the Taliban, and on the other side, pro-American commanders. I was in Kandahar in February, and I met a guy named Noor Atal. Noor is from Panjwai, a very violent area of Kandahar province. And 2 years ago, the Taliban showed up at his house and accused his brother of being an American spy. The reason they did that is because his brother worked for a demining agency. His brother had never met an American in his life. But he worked for a demining agency, and for the Taliban, that was enough to brand him as a spy. So they pulled him out of the house, brought him to a field, invited his family, invited the rest of the villagers, and summarily executed him. Because of this, his family fled to Kandahar City, where the government has strong control. 6 months ago, his other brother was working in a wood field, like a wood yard selling wood on the side of the street, when an Afghan police truck pulled up, pulled him into the vehicle and drove off. And that was the last time he saw his brother alive. 4 weeks later, four days later, he got a call from the tribal elder who found his brother's body in a police morgue. There were signs of torture, electrocution, and one of his eyes was ripped. This is not a mistake. Sometimes I mention this to people and say, oh, we've made blunders, we've supported the wrong people as a mistake. This is not a mistake. The person who did this was Abdul Razak. He's the police chief of Kandahar. It was not an error that we support Abdul Razak. My book goes into detail about cases like this, but there are also news reports about Abdul Razak. The most recent State Department report on human rights has a lengthy section on Abdul Razak and the Kandahar police and the tortures they've committed. So there's full knowledge of what's happening. The reason he is supported is because he kills Taliban very effectively. And we've ignored human rights in the name of the war on terror. And that is not just a case with Abdul Razak, that is a case with commanders and strongmen across the board. So to wrap up, there are two legacies here, really, in Afghanistan. There's a legacy of people in the cities who, and it's a fleeing legacy, because if we stop funding it, then it'll disappear tomorrow. And then there's the everyday lived legacy of people in the countryside that we should not ignore, which means really being ruled by fear and predation every single day. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Anand. David.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Anand. And I want to commend Anand's book to you. I think it's important that people read it. Because I think the kind of testimony of individuals, of communities that Anand reports on is important for Americans to read and to think about and to realize and to analyze along the ways that Anand said, and looking to look at the entire picture of what we have been part of in Afghanistan and what we are part of today and what we're going to be part of in the future. I know that the title of this session has legacy in it. Well, I would make a big circle and cross out the word legacy, and I would say future, America's future in Afghanistan. because legacy implies that it's something we can put behind us, that we don't bear any really responsibility for. We have no continuing moral responsibility for it, no continuing political interest in it, and that it is past history. And I think all of those are drastically wrong. Why do I say that? Well, let me go back to the first few brief sentences that Anand mentioned about the reality of Afghanistan today. On April 5th, there was an election in Afghanistan. On the morning of April 5th, my hometown newspaper, the Washington Post, published a story saying, Taliban threatened elections, turnout likely to be low. That, of course, was completely wrong. In fact, the turnout was twice what it was 5 years before. And the turnout, along the lines that Anand described, the people who reported back, both Afghans and the small number of Western reporters and observers who were there, was one of hope, one of optimism, and it tracked very well with a recent Asia Foundation study that was released in December. And I urge everyone who's interested in Afghanistan to look at it, because the Asia Foundation has been doing surveys of Afghanistan and Afghan people and their attitudes for the last 8 years, I believe. Their surveys people say, how can you do a survey in Afghanistan? Well, look at the backup there. They have some very serious professionals doing it. And they come up with startling figures, such as 70% of Afghan people think their country is headed in the right direction. And of course, if you know the statistics for the US, you realize it's about three times higher than it is here, and a lot higher than it is elsewhere. You'll come up with many other startling figures, such as 80% of the Afghan people support the Afghan army, and a smaller percentage, but not much smaller, about 70% support the Afghan police. And then you'll listen to anecdotes such as Anand has recounted, all of which are accurate, and you'll say, how can that be? Well, the answer, of course, is there's more than just a few anecdotes, there's more than a few. Anand has mentioned there are scores, there are hundreds, there are thousands of such stories as he recounted. But there are many other stories that are a different kind of story that are very positive. And if you talk to Afghan young people who are in college now, if you talk to many Afghan women, if you talk to not just people in Kabul, but if you talk to Afghans in Jalalabad, in Herat, in Mazar-e-Sharif, even in Host, the major city near Paktika province that Anand described, but even in Host, where the findings about people's hope in the future were really surprisingly high. Throughout Afghanistan, just to give a comparison, Kabul is a city somewhere between 5 and 8 million. Those are the various estimates that I've heard. Certainly well more than about 400,000 that were there when I first arrived in March 2nd of 2002. The population of Wardak province is about somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000. So in terms of what's happening in Afghanistan, it is by far the most important to pay attention to for Afghanistan's future, what's happening in urban and city areas. But at the same time, I'm not saying it's not important what happens in the rural areas, but there's been a major shift in Afghanistan over the past 10 years in population from urban to rural areas. It's very similar to, in fact, it's almost identical to the shift from rural to urban that happens everywhere, where you have an explosion in the population. The average age of the population in Afghanistan is under 20, and the population keeps getting younger every year. The urbanization of Afghanistan is proceeding at pace. In some cases, because of what's happening in the rural areas, it's driving people away from conflict because people don't want to be killed. But in many cases, because they see better economic personal opportunity in cities. And so particularly this is the case with people who have returned as refugees from Pakistan or Iran. Because once people have lived in refugee camps and had access to health care, education, and some of the accoutrements of the urban lifestyle, they find it very hard to go back to rural areas. Again, that's not just a situation that's unique to Afghanistan. It's pretty much similar to almost every other conflict that I'm aware of. once people enter a refugee camp, they feel much more comfortable in cities when they go back. So you're having this major change in Afghanistan of the rural to the urban. In the urban areas, you can certainly see lots of girls going to school. So in terms of the figures of girls going to school, if you look at all of Afghanistan and not just some of the rural areas near Kabul, but if you look at areas from the Panjshir to Herat to Jalalabad, you'll find that the figures for girls' education Anand is referring to are pretty reflective of reality. But I want to go back to Anand's comments, because I mentioned, I think it's very important, and that's why I urge people to read his book, as I've done. The kinds of abuses that he describes, abuses by U.S. forces, abuses by Afghan forces, abuses by individuals allied with us, those are the kinds of things that not only do we not expect, that we abhor. Why do they happen? Well, that's a subject that I think needs a lot of reflection. The book lays out this testimony. But as you step back and look at why, for example, the U.S. relied on warlords in 2001, if you go back in our history to the period of time after 9/11, when there was this huge outpouring in the United States of a desire to, number one, make sure that the attack on the World Trade Center never happened again, and number two, and this was a strong strain in our national character as well, to get vengeance. So we went into Afghanistan with a never again philosophy. We didn't go into Afghanistan with a nation building philosophy. We didn't go into Afghanistan with a plan of any kind about what we were going to do in Afghanistan. We went in to make sure that it never happened again. But we went in under a philosophy that smaller was better. We did not invade Afghanistan. If anyone says the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, they don't really understand what happened there. What we did is we sent small numbers of special forces and intelligence people into Afghanistan. But they relied for the intelligence they got. They relied for the majority of the manpower on local people who were, in many cases, people who we had funded in the 1980s. We had provided the funding through the ISI in Pakistan. And we tended to go back to the people we had worked with before. That put us into exactly the kind of very difficult moral situation that Anand described, because these were people with long track records of human rights abuses, long track records of using the money and weapons that they had gotten from the United States, from Pakistan, from Saudi Arabia, to carry out activities that during the Civil War, as Anand describes so horrifyingly in his book, activities that are so abhorrent that it's difficult to read about them. And I can tell you it's much more difficult to talk to people, as Anand has done, as I have done, who have suffered through these horrific events. But we had this national imperative, and we had a approach to warfighting at the top levels of our government, including in the Department of Defense at the time, that this small is better, that light footprint, shock and awe, all those phrases that you've heard of, all of which meant you had to rely on these warlords and their associates in order to try and have any hope of what you were doing. As I said, the United States didn't invade Afghanistan. When I got there in March, we had 15,000 troops in Afghanistan, and that's the same amount we had for essentially the first 18 months we were in Afghanistan. In fact, for a good portion of that time, we had less than 15,000. Afghanistan's a country of well over 20 million, incredibly difficult terrain, incredibly difficult terrain. You can't occupy a country with 15,000 troops, no matter how many aircraft you have in the sky above it. What you do is you have little spots where you take action. In order to take action, you rely on intelligence. And as Anand describes in his book, a portion of that intelligence was not just false intelligence, it was intelligence that was designed deliberately to manipulate what the United States and our allies were doing. And Anand lays out a number, again, of horrific stories about where that happens. But I'd say if you step back from that, why were we in that position? The reason we were in that position is because we sent too few troops into Afghanistan. We had to rely on local people, and it was a conscious decision to rely on local people, but we had to rely on them because we didn't have anything else. We also, as we did that, we had, as I said, we didn't go into Afghanistan with the intention of nation building. In fact, if you look at the budget that the Bush administration submitted February of 2002 to the United States Congress for assistance to Afghanistan, you'll find it was $1 million for new assistance to Afghanistan. Our original plan, and if you read the various memoirs by Secretary Rumsfeld, Secretary Feith, and a number of others, our original plan in Afghanistan was we would go in, we would attack, and then we would pull out and leave Afghanistan to its xenophobic, isolationistic, natural state of being. The problem was, when we got to Afghanistan, what we found was a completely different place. The Afghanistan that we thought we were going into wasn't the Afghanistan that was there. And what happened at the policymaking levels was there became huge disconnects between the policy of fighting a war light, not using very many troops, not providing much in the way of assistance, with the demands from people to help Afghan women, help Afghan children, to try and make a difference in Afghanistan. Those of you who follow politics will know that in the 2000 elections, George Bush ran on a policy of no more nation building, was one of the very strong national security themes that he ran on. In 2009, since 2009, President Obama has repeatedly stated the United States is not in Afghanistan to do nation building, that our objective is to build our nation here at home, not to build the nation of Afghanistan. So we've had two successive presidents who don't want to do nation building in Afghanistan. And I would submit that what Anand describes is are the results of trying to have a major impact with less than minimal resources. The example that Anand refers to of Wardak province in 2002, 3, and 4, when I was in Afghanistan, we regularly went to Wardak. We drove our own cars there. It was considered a fairly safe place. Because it was considered a fairly safe place, we didn't spend much money there. We didn't do much in the way of reconstruction. We didn't have many projects there because we didn't have much money, so we've decided to focus what we spent on the more conflict-ridden areas. As a result of that analytical failure, because of course the situation in Wardak was much more complicated, was not at all stable. The peace that we thought was there didn't exist, and there's a lot more history to why Wardak, by the time 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, when Anand went there, had deteriorated from the place that had been in 2002, 3, and 4. But I would submit the biggest one is because, for example, in 2005. Then Secretary of State Rice zeroed out all assistance to Afghanistan. The budget that was submitted to Congress added some additional money, but we zeroed out assistance to Afghanistan. There was a very strong shift of emphasis, both in terms of money, but more importantly in terms of people, from Afghanistan to Iraq, starting really in 2002. I saw that happen in March, April, and May of 2002 when I was in Afghanistan. Saw the shift of resources then from Afghanistan to Iraq. And that was a situation where the resources we had in Afghanistan were way too small. Flip forward, because I am trying to be responsive to Steve's desire to keep us on track.
Thank you.
Flip forward to 2009, and we had a president who was elected who said if Iraq was the wrong war, Afghanistan was something we should have done right, and conducted a series of policy reviews, which I was a very junior part of, resulting in the president's speech in December of 2009, where he announced a surge of 30,000 troops, which was 40,000 less than the commander had asked for, General Stanley McChrystal had asked for. And by the same time that we surged those 30,000 troops, that we were going to withdraw 10,000 in 18 months. What that meant was that we had to make choices about how we use the additional resources, military resources. There were some additional financial resources, there were some additional civilian resources. In my view, all, especially on the civilian side, way too little, which meant that we had to, we had to rely on the existing corrupt mechanisms that had a lot of the consequences that Anand mentioned. And we had to make choices. So we put our resources into number one, Helmand, number two, Kandahar. Wardak, Logar were going to be the second stage of the process. That never really happened. So in 2011 and 12, when according to the original campaign plan, we should have gone in there with sufficient force to make a difference. We went in with a smaller amount of force. We had troops on the we effectively had troops on the ground in most of Wardak and Logar for about 12 months, and then they withdrawn the last troops I think were pulled out in October of last year. So we left an area that we didn't start well and we finished poorly. And the situation that Anand describes, I think, is a natural, unfortunately, but natural result of us putting too little resources in, too little thought in, and leading to the kinds of disasters and horrific tragedies that he describes. But let me shift your attention to two other places. And the first among those is Helmand Province, where we put our first efforts into following the surge. And look at, say, for the elections in 2009, the elections of a month ago in terms of turnout. There was virtually no real voting in Helmand in 2009. 2014, there was very successful voting in a wide number of areas, particularly those areas, naturally, where the Afghan security forces are in reasonable control, including some of the areas that we went into first, such as the Marja district of Afghanistan, the area, the city of Lashkargah, which is now a functioning city as opposed to the non-functioning place that it was 5 years ago. So we found I was at a panel in London last week and afterwards had a chance to discuss the situation in Helmand with Katrina Lang, the last head of the British PRT. By the way, the British understood how to do the civil military part. We never really got it right, but the British PRT went there was very good. But the situation in Helmand has the capability of being sustainably affected in a very positive way by what happened over the last 5 years there. Is it a guarantee? No. Does it depend on what happens in the future? Yes. And that's why I say that the real topic of discussion here and elsewhere in the United States should be our future role with Afghanistan. Because if we were, as some have recommended, to adopt something called a zero option, where we pull out troops, cut all our assistance, and pretend Afghanistan never happened, then the future that Anand sketched is inevitable. However, we have learned a lot of lessons, and Anand has helped teach us some of those lessons. We have a lot of things that we have done wrong in Afghanistan. A lot of things that we know how to do better, and we know how to do better in many cases because of the mistakes we have made. But we need to continue learning from those mistakes. And we need to, both for national security, and I could talk about the issue of the resurgence of an Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan later. Afterwards, people want to hear more. But also for the very moral reasons that Anand has laid out implicitly in his book, because of the many huge tragedies that we and our allies and the people we have paid are responsible for, we can, and the Afghan people are prepared to work to this as well, as they showed in their turnout in the election, despite some really massive efforts by the Taliban to prevent the election from taking place. We have the opportunity to get Afghanistan much better than we ever have. But we won't do that, to be able to do that, unless we stay the course, which means continued military assistance, continued military presence, but also means an even bigger focus on the effective ways of providing civilian assistance, which we know about, which we know how to do. And happy to talk to, we'll have a period for questions and answers. I'll be happy to stay afterwards and talk to anyone who has additional questions beyond that afterwards. One final point, I wanted to note that I, along with a number of other people, some of who are here in this room, are a member of a very loose amalgamation of voices called the Alliance in Support of the Afghan People. This people ranging from Eleanor Smeal and Gloria Steinem to Ryan Crocker, Milan Vivier, people who come from many different areas of the ideological spectrum, Republican, Democrat, all of whom believe that the United States commitment in Afghanistan is one that should continue, not just past 2014, but well past 2014. That the successes we have had there and that balancing of analyses that Anand describes, those we and all of us have lived or worked, spent a lot of time in with Afghanistan over the last 12, 13 years, believe that that balance is in the positive now and can be much in the positive in the future if we continue that commitment. So I'll close with I'll close with an urging that you look at AfghanAlliance.org as the website. In it, you'll see a list of not just signatories from the U.S., but Afghan signatories, Afghans who believe that a continuing partnership with the United States, despite, and these Afghans know the things that Anand has written about, despite those terrible things that have happened to their society, they believe that a continuing partnership with the United States is the best way to secure the kind of future for Afghanistan that they want and we should want. This is about Anand's book, but I'm going to mention another book. This is a book called The Wrong Enemy by Carlotta Gall, who has lived and worked in Afghanistan and Pakistan for the past 20 years. Both books came out within a couple weeks of each other. They both take very different tacks. The title of Carlotta's book, The Wrong Enemy, it's pretty clear just from the title, and as soon as you read the book, it's pretty clear who she thinks the real enemy is. I'll just close by saying that the issue of Pakistan and how to deal with Pakistan and the problems and challenges that Pakistan will pose both for itself and the region, as not just Afghanistan, but the broader region and the world, is one that I think deserves very serious attention and one that I don't have any answers for. If you read Anand's book, you should also read Carlotta's book. You'll come up with very different perspectives from those. But I think that's very important as people look to come up with a clear picture that you listen and read about these different perspectives before you come to your own judgments. Steve?
Great. All right, well, So thank you both, and obviously there's an opportunity for you to reply to one another as we go along. I guess, though, for my portion of the questioning, I'm going to try to cross-examine each of you once and see where that leads, I think we probably all share, notwithstanding the fact that we all lapse into it, a desire to avoid the kind of half-full, half-empty sort of argument in broad strokes, because as our friend Barney Rubin once said memorably, at least I've never forgotten this line, optimism is just a state of brain chemistry. And it's really better to analyze what we think the structure of events and the structure of the current strengths and weaknesses of political stability, inclusion, rights, in Afghanistan really amounts to. What is the structure of the insurgency? Are we seeing the whole picture? What are we missing? And then trying to stitch it together. And I think you both did a great job of that. But I want to keep us focused on that kind of map rather than on the sort of narrative of optimism or pessimism. And so, Anand, in the context of the American legacy and your very powerful account of the instrumentalism of the Abdul Razaks of American policy, and recognizing, as you would have occasion to do from the ground up, that the Afghanistan that American policy arrived in again in 2001 was utterly shattered. I mean, really, by the Human Development Index metrics, by any governance metric, by infrastructure, by mortality. It was one of the three or four poorest countries in the world. And as you point out, all of this investment and money, and not to mention the flow of troops carrying out policies like COIN for intermittent periods, you know, had a provocative effect, unintended consequences that were often damaging, if not outright sort of horrifying in some cases. I guess my question is, what's the alternative policy that you would argue for looking ahead? It's not surprising that in such a shattered place, and there are many other shattered lands where we find warlords and criminal gangs linked to government, and, but you know as well as anyone else that the alternative of Afghan governance in these places is just as criminal an operation in many cases as Abdul Razak's outfit. Certainly, you know, in Kandahar, the government was running private jails and extorting civil and criminal defendants and essentially a systematic bribery machine, and is still mistrusted by many Afghans for that reason. I guess, from your experience, what are the instruments of international policy in Afghanistan looking ahead that ought to be emphasized to slowly, gradually, and in a realistic way, make it less likely that the John Muhammads and the Abdul Razaks can thrive, and more likely that they can be held to account without destabilizing the country?
I think first we should start with a little context, which is that, you know, there are poor countries, and there are poor countries that have warlords and narco-terrorists and et cetera. Afghanistan's in the latter case. Warlordism in Afghanistan is actually a modern phenomenon, something else I described in the book. Before 1979, there were all sorts of problems in the country, you know, corruption and poverty, but there were no warlords. That's a consequence of the Soviet invasion, killing thousands and tens of thousands of tribal elders and village heads, and of the U.S., which Steve is, you know, the main person who's written about this and described how this has happened, of the CIA's patronage of commanders and in the process creating the warlords we see today. But looking ahead, so the point there is that warlordism is necessarily natural to Afghanistan. That also is a consequence of policies. But looking ahead, I would identify three main problems that are challenges that Afghanistan faces. Number one, of course, is the Taliban insurgency, which is supported by Pakistan. Number two is the system of dual power, a very weak government in Kabul and towns, and a very powerful network of warlords in the countryside. And number three is a state that's completely unsustainable, as I described. So to address these, we should hit each in turn. First, if we look at the network of warlords, they exist because of US patronage, because of the war on terror. And instead of supporting people like Azizullah, who was the person I described in Paktika, we should fund the Afghan government. And what that means is, today, 80% of all aid that's going to Afghanistan actually bypasses the Afghan state. And you may think, okay, the Afghan government is very corrupt. How could you give money to the Afghan government? But in fact, there's various mechanisms around this. There's trust funds that the police are paid out of a trust fund, in which are jointly managed by the international community and the Afghan state. You know, there are various ways to do this, but the point is to direct patronage to the center, not to the periphery. If you direct patronage to the periphery, you weaken the center and you ensure the continued existence of the Taliban and of this culture of impunity that I've described. That's the first step. The second step is the Afghan state is not sustainable. It would not survive without the U.S. and foreign countries supporting it. So we need to really rethink the Afghan economy. We cannot have this situation where the Afghan economy exists because of foreign aid. Okay, Afghanistan actually now has mineral resources. But the dominant paradigm, the intellectual paradigm, political paradigm of the last 10 years has been privatization and giving all these resources to the highest bidder, and that opens the door to corruption. We can actually look to the way in which developing countries in the 50s and 60s actually came, were able to develop a resource base, were able to tax their citizenry, That includes, for example, think about nationalizing some of these industries. This is a system that people in Afghanistan remember because of the communist time, right? Of course, there's an issue of capacity building, which can be done. But you know, we need to start thinking about how do we get the Afghan government to be self-sustainable, not to be what's called in political science a rentier state, which is what it is today. And third, in terms of the Taliban insurgency, that we need to redouble our efforts to come to a negotiated settlement. I don't believe, I'm actually very pessimistic at the possibility that the Taliban today will negotiate. For the same reason why they did try to negotiate in 2001, which is I described in the book. In 2001, their backs were against the wall, and so they had no choice if they tried to negotiate. Today, their backs are not against the wall, and so there's less incentive to negotiate. But there's confidence-building measures that can happen, including, let's say, trading the five people in Guantanamo for the US POW that's there. I think this negotiations process should happen in addition to, it shouldn't be a backroom deal between the US leadership and Pakistan and the Taliban. It should actually be inclusive, it should incorporate sections of Afghan civil society. But even if we can't get there, even if we can't negotiate and get to sort of the grand bargain with the Taliban, the very act of trying to do so, I think, will yield a number of positive benefits, which in the long run will get to the state which we all want, which is an Afghanistan that's not at war.
Great. We can come back to some of these themes. David, an implication of your history about the underinvestment in Afghanistan, both in Reconstruction aid but also in forces in the period after 2002, is that there was an alternative history that would have made things better in terms of, you know, massive early aid flows into this broken, weak state with these kinds of warlords in the countryside, because they were in control, of course, in those days in many places, in Herat and in Balkan and other places. And that also, that if we had brought in more either peace enforcement troops out of NATO or somehow blue-helmeted the international forces in Afghanistan and spread them out, that this might have succeeded. But how confident are you in that alternative history? Because we did surge all of these troops into the country in 2009, 2010. They found themselves in a very provocative fight in the south with Taliban that seemed to rise up almost to challenge their very presence as much as for any other reason. And while we can accept that this hypothesis of xenophobia that governed the Bush administration in 2001, 2002 was profoundly misplaced and led to policy mistakes, it doesn't necessarily follow that a large international troop presence immediately after the fall of the Taliban would have stabilized the country.
I think that's an excellent set of questions, and I'm not so sure the real question is how confident am I, because
well, you're my guest.
My level of confidence is not so relevant. But let's take three specific areas. The first and most important one is the issue of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. That's why, of course, we went into Afghanistan. We didn't go into Afghanistan because in 1998, then a spokesperson for Ahmad Shah Massoud testified before the United States Congress saying that Afghanistan is going to become a threat to you because of al-Qaeda's presence there. And if you want to go back and look at that testimony, you can see some pretty prescient statements by Dr. Abdullah to the U.S. Congress in 98. But we didn't go in there because we were warned. We went in there because we died. And we went in to go after al-Qaeda, but we went in, as I said, with this very light footprint. Anand has a very telling and I think quite accurate story in his book about his discussions with one of the warlords of Jalalabad, one of the people who actually made a lot. He made about $10 million by selling Jalalabad to the Taliban, because the Taliban took over Jalalabad by paying off this guy and two other warlords. But he talks about how he got $5 million from the CIA, he got $1 million from Osama bin Laden, and he tried to get $500,000 from the ISI, but the ISI said no. I think that's the basic outline of the story.
Yeah, that's right.
Why were we doing that? We were doing that because we didn't have the troops on the ground. Recently, there's a book called 102 Days of War. I'm promoting too many people's books here. You should buy Anand's book tonight, please. The 102 Days of War by Yanni Barzilai, and he discusses the 102 days from September 11th through December when we were trying to catch Osama bin Laden. Of course, we failed that time. And he recounts in it, for example, that Jim Mattis, one of our Marine commanders, had a plan to bring Marines up out of the Kandahar airfield where they were, up into the Tora Bora area, and they would be the ones who would go after after Osama bin Laden. That was turned down in favor of paying money to the resurgent warlords trying to work with small numbers of special forces and intelligence people. That obviously failed. Would the Mattis plan or others of bringing in a sufficient force to go after Osama bin Laden then and really changing the course of history? Am I confident that would have happened? I know, I can't say I'm confident, but I think the chances of a better outcome would have been much higher if we had used significant amounts of American forces rather than trying to do this ad hoc effort. So that's one area. Secondly, when the Taliban fled, because the Taliban weren't really defeated, they fled. The leadership fled to Pakistan. A lot of the soldiers just tried to go back to their farms, and Anand talks about some of these stories. But that left a vacuum. One thing we know from every conflict area that there is no actually such thing as a vacuum. Security will be provided one way or another by one group or another. And the people who were best positioned because they had the ability to mobilize the instruments of violence were these people who were warlords before the Taliban came and who then became warlords after. Because we didn't have the ability to offer any alternative, there was no alternative for security in 90%+ of Afghanistan. In fact, the United States made it a condition of the first iterations of the International Security Assistance Force that it was compliant to Kabul. It couldn't act outside of that. If you go back and look at the discussions with the UN and elsewhere, the first commander of the International Security Assistance Force, a gentleman named John McCall, and our first diplomat in charge of, I had the great honor to work for, Ryan Crocker, came up with a plan in the spring of 2002 to have fairly small numbers of forces, along with civilians, fan out through all Afghanistan and have charge of the transition to a government, but provide security in those areas. That plan was rejected by the Bush administration in Washington. And as a result, those warlords that Anand describes cemented their role. And once you have that kind of a structure in place, it's much more difficult to change it. So at the very period of time, we could have made a huge difference, I think, with a larger but still fairly small number of forces. We chose to do nothing, and that left 90% of Afghanistan on its own. The numbers of forces that we had in Afghanistan, as I said, about 15,000. Well over 12,000 of those were in Bagram in 2002. The actual number of U.S. forces outside, and another 1,000 or so were in Kandahar. We just didn't have any presence in most of Afghanistan. And as a result, we had to rely on intelligence, carried out the kinds of raids that Anand described, which were really horrific in the way they damaged the people of Afghanistan, damaged our ability to succeed, and made the effort in 2009 so much harder. The other thing, however, I'll stress is Pakistan. And again, if you read both books, you'll see that that there's another narrative that the resurgence of the Taliban goes back to the head of the ISI's meeting with Mullah Omar in the fall of 2001, where he told Mullah Omar, "Don't surrender, don't give up. We will continue to support you. The Americans will leave in 6 months or so, and you'll be back in charge." With that narrative, Mullah Omar's departure from Afghanistan to Pakistan is not at all a flight of someone who doesn't know what he's doing. It's very much in the context, and Anand has a very good story in his book of a visit of a Taliban commander to Pakistan, where the lead in making decisions about the strategic disposition of Taliban forces in Wardak is made by an officer of ISI, the Pakistani intelligence. So the role of Pakistan during that period of time, whether we could have countered that role of Pakistan during that time, I don't know. But I think that's one of the harder questions to ascertain an answer to.
So one more question for me, and then we'll open it up and finish up by 7:30 when Anand will be outside at that table you pass by signing the books that I know you're all going to want to get as you leave. Anand, about the strength and the structure of the Taliban insurgency today. So you can look at different goals declared by military commanders or civilian cabinet members of the Obama administration saying what they intended to do when they increased American combat troop deployments to Afghanistan. But essentially their goal was, as they described it, was to break the momentum of the Taliban insurgency and to stabilize the situation enough so that the Afghan government could certainly prevent the Afghan government's overthrow by the Taliban, the loss of any major cities, and to stanch, if not roll back, the Taliban insurgency. So all these 5 years later, lots of blood and treasure, at the time of that hard fighting in Kandahar and Helmand, America was in a deep recession that turned inward, and so the casualties and the suffering that American and international, as well as Afghan combatants went through, was probably a little bit underplayed in comparison to the Iraq War, but it was a bloody fight. So what's the result? It looks like the number of districts controlled by the Taliban overall is more or less the same as it was. Not more, but not less. No major city has fallen. When district centers fall or are influenced, they're either left alone in a kind of undeclared acceptance of shared rule or they're taken back. But how stable now are these achievements, in your judgment, given Pakistani policy, given Taliban resources, and given public attitudes?
I think they're actually fairly stable. I think you're right in saying that the surge stopped the Taliban's momentum. It didn't reverse the momentum. So the Taliban are still entrenched in villages and in the countryside. The government is still entrenched in the city. In many respects, it looks somewhat similar to 1989, in which the government was controlling the cities and some highways, and the Islamic rebels at the time were controlling villages. The Taliban today is probably not as popular, or doesn't have as much popular support as the Mujahideen did in the 1980s. So that's one difference. But I don't think the Afghan government will be able to march into these villages and kick them out. And they're going to stay there. I don't think the Taliban is going to be able to march into Kabul and overthrow the Afghan government. So what we're looking at is essentially the status quo in perpetuity. What we're looking at is a war of attrition with two sides entrenched and no end in sight.
All right, so let's take some questions from the audience. And so we'll start here and come over to you, Bill.
Hi, Chris Thomas from the Legal Department at OSI. Two very quick questions. The first one for David. You mentioned 15,000 U.S. troops being sent in, but did you mention anything about private military troops that may have also gone in? So I was curious if there were any figures on that. And then similarly, for Mr. Anand, you had mentioned special forces, and I was also curious, as they have been such a hot topic in the U.S., anything you might have come across in terms of private military troops that may have committed abuses and were overlooked or not? Just to clarify, not Afghani private security, but private military forces from the U.S.
I'll start because the figures I used, 15,000 were the U.S. forces in 2002, in March of 2002 when I arrived, and basically that was the same through almost all of 2002. At that point, there were no private security contractors. When we went into Afghanistan, that was before the private security contracting phenomenon. Industry became really big. Our forces carried out their own security. By the time, say, 2003 or 4 came in, then we had the beginnings of those private security contractors. But when they really exploded was after 2004, for two reasons. One, because there was a huge demand for them in Iraq, and so the companies involved were able to supply a lot of them, and so there was a big supply. And because in Afghanistan, we didn't have anywhere near the number of forces that we needed, we tended to use a lot of, we compensated for lack of military forces in that period, 2004, 5, 6, with private security forces. But in the time that I was referring to, 2001, 2, and 3, the number of forces we had was not augmented by those forces, because that was a phenomenon that came a couple years later.
In terms of private security contractors and forces, if you're thinking about like Blackwater and DynCorp and these, they're not a major factor. I mean, DynCorp is there. I think Blackwater might be there in some capacity, but they're not a major factor. The way it works actually is through subcontracting. The biggest contract over the last few years is something called Host Nation Trucking, which is a contract by the Defense Department to a series, 7 or 8, I think, companies to deliver supplies between bases. And this is in the, probably, I think, close to $1 billion or something. Those companies, mostly American companies, then go and subcontract it out to Afghans. And these aren't, when you say Afghans, we mean Afghan warlords. Or this is really the process of creating Afghan warlords. And so these are really the private security forces that have been in play over the last 10 years. There's been a push by the Afghan government to try to absorb these private security forces into the government, because it's recognized that their very existence is destabilizing to the country. And there's been a push back against that by embassies and by the military, saying that we need short-term security and not thinking about the sort of long-term security of the Afghan state.
So I can just add that that particular issue of foreign private security forces has been a very major political issue in Afghanistan. President Karzai issued a decree several years back barring their use except for prevention of our protection of diplomatic establishments and military for a short period of time, created in its place something called the Afghan Public Protection Force, which was going to be a state-run organization under the control of the Ministry of Interior. It took over when the foreign private security forces were forced to cease formal operation. But that Afghan Public Protection Force had a very mixed performance, and there was a decree by the Minister of Interior, by the President, saying the Ministry of Interior should take over the Public Protection Force about 2 months ago. So that whole issue right now is very murky about where it is in Afghanistan.
So we'll go to the back, the gentleman in the back, then we'll come across this way and come up.
Hi there, my name's Harris. I actually reside in Canada, just here for the day. I don't have a question, I just have a point. I happened to be in Afghanistan 2 months ago for a family visit. And warlords, to be honest with you, are the least of our problems right now in the country. I think it's a product of a political gong show for the past 30, 35 years. And this is a process by which warlords are going to weed themselves off, or the public, or the democratic process is going to weed them out. Because we see the political spectrum right now during the elections, we have so many warlords that have flipped the switch. These are people who held guns and now they're part of the political process where they're running as vice presidents or presidents for election process. I think when we talk about the American legacy in Afghanistan, I think even the ordinary African citizen looks at that legacy from the prism of how the U.S. dealt with Pakistan, and not necessarily how it worked in Afghanistan. I belong to Logar province, and it's one of the most volatile regions in the country, and it's difficult to talk about the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and Logar, but when I talked to my cousins there, they said that ordinary Africans do not expect the Americans to come build establishments here. I think we could take care of that ourselves. It's going to be a process where eventually we will get there. But what frustrates Afghans is how the U.S., willingly or unwillingly, has sat quiet and seen what the Pakistani government or ISI establishment has done in terms of supporting militants in Pakistan, not only not only attack the American soldiers in Afghanistan, but also take a shot at the local population. So when you talk about American legacy in Afghanistan, the fundamental understanding that it has to be that the American foreign policy in Pakistan or towards Pakistan, its lack of engagement in Pakistan, or its lack of transparency in how it's dealt with Pakistan, plays a huge role. Because at the end of the day, I think all will be forgotten. As soon as the U.S. soldiers leave, this issues of human rights violations, all that stuff, that will probably fly out of the window. But how you dealt with Pakistan is what is something that people are going to remember for a long time.
So rather than asking you to respond to that, because that's a welcome and highly credible voice, why don't we just move along, and if you want to respond to it later, this woman in the back, and then we'll come up this side.
Yeah, my name is Helen Redman, and my question is for Mr. Sedney, because I'm not sure where you're coming down on this question. And for me, when I look at the war in Afghanistan, there's sort of three goals that I think it had, which I'd like you comment on. The first was, when the U.S. went in, they said, we're going to defeat the Taliban, that they are terrorists, and we have to defeat them. They harbored bin Laden, etc. And we're not going to negotiate with terrorists. But in fact, the U.S. hasn't defeated the Taliban, and there have been negotiations back channel and other. So on that score, the U.S. Failed. The second one is the war on drugs. A new report just came out from the Special Inspector General that showed that there's been a 36% increase in poppy production, and the U.S. has spent $8.4 billion to make Afghanistan poppy-free. So that's a failure as well. The third one is liberating women. It really seems like it was a lifetime ago that Laura Bush went on television and said, this is a war to liberate the women in Afghanistan from the horrible, brutal Taliban. And feminists jumped on the bandwagon. You mentioned Gloria Steinem, Elmer Smeal, Hillary Clinton. And women clearly have not, the vast majority of women have not been liberated in Afghanistan. So on those three metrics, the war is a failure. And I just want to add, when the war came home, we're still dealing with that. So the latest scandal at the VA, 40 people have died waiting for treatment, and 22 veterans commit suicide every single day. That is a legacy that we should not forget. So are you saying that the war and occupation was worth it? Are you saying that it was a success in any way? Would you answer that question?
Sure, I'd be happy to, and I'll answer a very strong yes in the affirmative that it was worth it. And I'll go through the three points that you made. The first is, you mentioned our goal going into Afghanistan. The goal going into Afghanistan was to defeat al-Qaeda and stop further attacks on the United States from al-Qaeda. That was goal number one. Goal number two was to ensure that the al-Qaeda could not come back into Afghanistan and therefore make sure the Taliban could not regain control of Afghanistan by building Afghan security forces that could prevent that from happening. And number three, the goal was to help Afghan society progress as much as possible. Those were the goals that were, if you go back and read what the Bush administration said, read what President Obama said, read documents that I helped write, those were the goals. So first on al-Qaeda, in terms of Afghanistan, al-Qaeda is not a factor in Afghanistan now. There are a few, probably in the scores, al-Qaeda, foreign al-Qaeda who are in northeastern Afghanistan in the Konar-Nuristan area, very much integrated with the local population, very heavily intermarried with them, and who right now don't have any ambition or any capability to act outside of Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda leaders, as we have known for some time, all went to Pakistan, where they are now. I think it's fair to say that we have degraded al-Qaeda's ability to attack the United States and our allies, that not just the killing of Osama bin Laden, but the killing of numbers of others of the al-Qaeda leadership have made it so Al-Qaeda is very much in a defensive position when it comes to the United States. At the same time, Al-Qaeda has evolved from a more centralized organization that did most of its planning and work in Pakistan. Now it's a very decentralized organization with affiliates in Yemen, in Saudi Arabia, in Iraq, in Syria, Somalia, other places in Africa. And those affiliates are, in some cases, autonomous. In some cases, for example, in Syria right now, they're having serious internal difficulties between the official Al-Qaeda, least sanctioned area, sanctioned group, and one that's against it. So how have we done relating to Al-Qaeda overall as a threat? I think it's a very open question. In terms of Afghanistan, we were able to do that. In terms of Afghanistan vis-a-vis the Taliban, again, our goal, and we were very careful about this, to not say our goal was to defeat the Taliban. Our goal was to degrade the Taliban to where the Afghan security forces could handle the threat. So the kind of situation that Steve and Anand were describing before, where the U.S. and other allied troops went into Afghanistan in the surge in 2009, pushed the Taliban out of a number of areas where they were in 2009, 10, 11, and the beginning of 2012. And since that time, there's been a status that's pretty much stayed the same. All those gains have been maintained, but no new gains have been made. Obviously, Anand and I will have a disagreement there. I've spent a lot of time with the Afghan security forces. I think the odds are very, very good that they're going to make further progress over the next 3 to 5 years, despite what I expect to be a very strong push by the Taliban this summer. In terms of Afghan women, I agree with you that there are huge problems and throughout Afghanistan with the Afghan women. But to say it's been a failure, I think you'd have to talk to Afghan women themselves. I don't know if we have any here who can speak for themselves. I have found that the best spokesman for Afghan women are Afghan women, not me. I'm neither woman nor Afghan. But I do listen to Afghan women. Every time I travel to Afghanistan, I was last there in December, I always make a point to listen to Afghan women. And the message I hear repeatedly is they are better off now than they were under the Taliban, better off now than they were in the years immediately following afterwards. And one of the ways they're better off is they understand how many problems they have to face. And those problems can be crushing. They can be dispiriting. And it's amazing to talk to Afghan women who are 24 years old and have founded 20 schools and under death threats all the time, but continue to do things that I can't imagine myself doing in an atmosphere of violence.
So that's a very thorough.
I apologize.
Very thorough response. But I think listening to her question, I was expecting you to concede that the war on drugs failed.
I didn't talk about the war on drugs because if you look at official U.S. government policy, we were there to help the British. The British had the lead on the war on the war on drugs in Afghanistan. We tried to help, and we have not succeeded. If our goal was to make Afghanistan poppy-free, we would have failed, but that was never our goal. Our goal was to try and reduce the role that narcotics played in the Afghan economy, and there we have failed. The role that narcotics plays in the Afghan economy, and particularly the role that increasingly over the last 2 years that narcotics have played in funding the Taliban. I think probably one-third to one-half of the Taliban funds today in 2014 are coming from narcotics trade, very different than it was in, say, 2010-11 when it was probably 10 or 20%. So that's an area where you're correct. We have failed. But if you look at efforts everywhere else in the world to address the drug problem, from Colombia to Turkey to Thailand, you'll see that carrying out this kind of effort requires a much higher level of committed civilian resources than we've ever put into in Afghanistan. If you look at the amount of resources, for example, that are put into play in Colombia in terms of governance, rule of law, agricultural assistance in areas, you'll see that the spending in Colombia under Plan Colombia is somewhere 10, around at least 10 times as much per person on the counter-drug efforts in Afghanistan. So again, I'll go back to the resource issue. We've never put the kind of resources that would be necessary in Afghanistan, and they would be huge to address the drug problem.
So we've reached 7:25. I promised Bill that he could ask his question, and this gentleman is anxious to ask his question. So we'll collect those two. And then David has said that he'd be happy to answer questions from, are you an Afghan woman? Okay, well then, I was going to make an exception, but on the grounds that he was inviting your voice. We'll collect your voice as well, and then we'll let them respond, and then Anand's going to sign books, and as you buy a book, you also purchase a question. And then David is going to provide his questions without compensation. So, please.
I just had a quick follow-up to her question. Could Anand respond to what she said about Afghan women and their liberation whenever he has a chance?
Correct. So we'll let them each of the questioners speak, and then we'll ask you to respond to those questions that you feel prepared to address.
Hi, I'm Bill McGowan, journalist, author, and I run a blog called Coloring the News. My question is to all three of you, one of you three, in the spirit of living in the solution as opposed to the problem, which is also living in the problem too. Which part of our government is doing a postmortem in the most meaningful, holistic way of what went wrong across the middle? Across the military platforms, the nation building platforms, the anthropological platforms, the culture matters platform. Is anybody actually putting this all together now in real time, trying to figure out what went wrong? Because, I mean, to remind ourselves why we got in there, it was basically to trounce Al-Qaeda, to deny them a platform. The nation building came afterward. So if we have to do it again, in a climate, an economic climate, where nation building is perceived as unaffordable, you know, who is actually standing up and trying to discern where it went off track? Is there, you know, is it Navy War College, the Army War College, Leavenworth, blah, blah, blah.
One last for this gentleman who's been there. Yes.
My name is Mike Diedrich. I spent most of the year in Afghanistan in 2012. Came back from Iraq in 2005, rather cynical. Came back from Afghanistan, even more cynical regarding our U.S. government. And my question is kind of a basic one, which is, we in the United States learned in our own revolution things about human nature and basic human values. So why don't we apply those things to other countries, the prime example being the topic today, Afghanistan? Why don't we, when we go and deal with a country like that, talk in terms of, to that government, you need checks and balances, because if you don't have checks and balances within your government, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. Why don't you respect the idea that people want to be able to petition their government regarding redress so they have justice? In other words, things that our founding fathers dealt with and that we feel central to our government, we seem not to apply in places where I think it would work. I think those concepts would have worked and helped Afghanistan tremendously. And instead, it seems that we Americans, when we go to foreign places, we just forget our basic values. And that's my question.
Choose some, all. You can't do none, but.
The three-word answer to that, I think, is the war on terror. That's four words. The war on terror, I think, is the reason for that. Because, I mean, sometimes you hear that Afghanistan is not ready for democracy, that it's not ready for sort of Western-style government. I don't think that's true. I think Afghans are very ready for democracy, but they have to be enabled to have a democratic system. When we pursue a war on terror, which means not thinking about checks and balances or redress, but actually incentivizing people to kill bad guys or who we think are bad guys, a whole host of other effects ensue. And this has been the primary problem from day one, I think, and that's what the book talks about. There's a question about which part of our government is doing a postmortem. I mentioned it before, the Special Investigator General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, SIGAR, You really should go and read their reports. John Sopko is the head of it. He's, I think, a brilliant guy, and he just gave a speech the other day that was just published on the web that discusses his views and Sigar's views on these things. They actually do go and go through a lot of what's happening now and try to take hold it to account. And if you read the report, the most recent report was came out in April, you would see that, for example, things like the Asia Study Foundation, which David mentioned in his remarks, actually are deeply problematic. You know, they describe how there's all sorts of issues with the way in which polling is done in a place like Afghanistan. I learned this the hard way when I first landed in Afghanistan in 2008. I went out. There was an attack in a village outside of the main city, outside of Kabul. And I went to the house and I interviewed the guy. I asked him what happened, and he explained everything. And then I started asking questions about, do you support the Taliban? Do you support the Americans? He pulled a gun to my head. This is a war zone. This is where your political affiliations or expressing your political affiliations can be a matter of life or death. This is not a place where you can conduct polls, particularly in half the country where the war is being fought. And this is why studies like the Asia Study poll, which says that 70% of Afghans are optimistic in the future, are deeply suspect. The Sigar report describes not only that general aspect of it, that you don't conduct polls in war zones, but also the specifics. For example, you know, one of the ways in which you poll is the so-called Kish grid, which is you go into a village and you pick a house, and then you go, you follow an algorithm. You pick the first house, and you go 30 steps, and you make a left, and you pick the next house, go 30 steps, and you know, make another left. And through that, you develop a random sample of the village. If you try to do this in a place like Wardak, you will probably end up in a grainy YouTube video somewhere, you know, in captivity. You know, this is not something that's done, right? What the Sigar report describes for the Asia Study Foundation, which, by the way, was subcontracted to an Afghan company, is that they got people, they tried to find people in the war-torn areas, brought them to the city and asked them, you know, what do you think about the war? It's a deeply problematic methodology. So I would caution you not to listen to these sorts of polling. They're just absolutely inaccurate. On the question of Afghan women, and this goes back to the remarks I had in the beginning, which are, there really are two narratives here, or two stories, okay? In Kabul and in Shamali and these kinds of places, it's undeniable that Afghan women's lives have improved because of the last 10 or 12 years. Because under the Taliban, we all know what they went through. However, on the flip side of that question is what is happening in Wardak or Paktika or Khost or these areas. And let's look at that. In the 1990s, in a place like Paktika, if you're a woman, you are kept inside your house and you're not allowed to leave. You are not allowed to have an education. You are not allowed to have access to health care. Today, in Paktika, you're kept inside your house. You're kept away from education. You're not allowed to have access to health care. On top of that, you're living in a war zone. So you can tell me how the situation is compared to that. And this is the story of Hila, who's the sort of the main person I follow in my book, who grew up in Kabul, had sort of she went to Kabul University, she majored in economics. You know, her husband was a communist, so he was very forward-thinking in terms of women's rights. And she was somebody who was very strong-willed and independent. And she was forced, because of the war, to move to rural Uruzgan province. And you see the difference. And one of the most striking things to me when I was interviewing her is I asked her, can you describe how you felt when the Taliban were toppled and the US backed regime took over? And she told me she couldn't even remember the day. And it's because, from her point of view, in this rural village, it didn't make a difference. She was locked in her house. You know, so if we really care about the rights of women in Afghanistan, we have to look about, of course, we have to look about education and healthcare. We also have to look about the fact that their sons and their husbands are dying in roadside bombs, and the fact that they're stuck in a house for reasons that are more complicated than just the Taliban. Of course, the Taliban are a major problem, but there are many reasons for this, and that needs to be addressed.
Great. I think that's a very thorough. And so, David, the last.
Well, first of all, on the issue of polling, obviously Anand and I are 180 degrees apart on this. I will refer people to the Asia Foundation poll. They're well aware of the critiques of people like the Sigar, and I would urge people to be very cautious when you read the Sigar studies. I'll be happy to discuss a number of the Sigar studies that have serious flaws, and the one that Anand just mentioned. He's correct that doing polling in war zones are difficult, but the Asia Foundation people who did this, who did contract the actual carrying out of the polls to different Afghan groups, but they are very serious, very professional people. I've spoken to them, I've relayed those concerns, I've raised those concerns with them, and found that they are very serious people who actually know what they're doing. Unfortunately, the CIGAR people didn't talk to the people who they criticize. It's one of the weaknesses of CIGAR reports is they often criticize things where they don't do enough research on them. Obviously we think very differently on that, so I urge all of you to go out and those of you who are familiar with the Asia Foundation, I urge you to talk to the people there if you want to follow this up. In terms of serious study about there's none. And it probably is too soon. There are various fragmented things. The CIGAR reports tend to be about very often very tiny specific things. They're sometimes brought together, but they're nowhere near a serious systematic effort. One of the things that, because I would say that there is no reason to have a study of the failures, because as I said before, there have been many successes as well. So an evaluation, and I described those successes in what I said earlier. It's very important, I think, when you look at, again, going back to the elections, the narrative that all of you hear from the U.S. media is so flawed that it's very difficult for you to understand what's really going on in Afghanistan. The 100 and 200,000 people in Logar and Wardak that Anand is talking about, he's right about what's happened to them. But if you're talking about what's happened to millions of Afghan women, they're the ones, millions of Afghan women are much better off. Are the hundreds of thousands of women in the areas that Anand's talking about worse off than they were? Yes, there are people who are worse off, there are people who are better off. But you have to look at this thing from a broader strategic area. It's very important to recognize the failures, but if all you do is talk about failure, then you can't see the success. And I saw a number of people, and I said success in Afghanistan, and they shook their head. Come up to me afterwards, and I can lay out to you where those successes are. But even more importantly, talk to Afghans themselves, and talk to Afghans from everywhere in Afghanistan. Talk to them both from the areas, but talk to them based upon the number of people that they represent. Because I would argue that, I do argue very strongly that many more Afghans are much better off today than they were in 2001, 2005, or 2008. Yes, there are some, and it's important that our media cover those, but unfortunately our media focuses on the problems. They get a lot more mileage. Their editors publish stories about negative stuff. They just won't tell you the story about what's really happening in Afghanistan. I see the Afghan colleague saying there, what is the number one problem in Afghanistan, according to most Afghans? And I'm talking about most Afghans throughout the whole country. It's unemployment. That's the number one problem that's identified over and over again by Afghans. Warlords are a problem, but unemployment's worse. And the big issue of Pakistan, that again our Afghan colleague raised, that's one that I don't think any of the three of us here have an answer to.
Great. So we've run out of time for this part of the program. As I mentioned before, Anand and David will be available to speak to you as individuals. Anand's going to go sign books. I'd like to thank you for the seriousness of your questions, for the patience of your engagement. Please applaud our two panelists.